policy. I don't know. Do we want to do? How about we do a 5-minute break? We'll come back at 20 to 12. We're going to move on to agenda item number 10. So this is a time and place by hearing to the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, North Coast Region, to consider adopting resolution number R-2012-0013, policy for implementation of the water quality objective for temperature of the North Coast Region. This item's been properly noticed. We'll start with the staff presentation and we'll take oral comments after that. And by the way, just to let everybody know, we're going to go through this agenda item and then we'll break for lunch. Assume that'll be somewhere around 12:30 if things go per plan. Mr. McFadden.
No, she said not. Good morning, Mr. Chairman Noren.
Thank you.
And members of the board. for the record, Brian McFadden of your staff. I'm here to discuss two things. The first is consideration of resolution R-1-2012-0013. And if appropriate, direction to staff from this board on the scope of a temperature policy basin plan amendment. I'm just going to do my presentation off of notes. I won't have a PowerPoint. First, I'd like to just briefly review what this resolution is about. This resolution describes in one cohesive document the approach to implementing the water quality objective for temperature. It underscores the importance of water temperature, identifies important temperature factors, and gives staff specific direction in order to meet basin plan standards and prevent future impairments. It identifies activities that can elevate water temperatures and directs staff to address temperature concerns using existing authorities and processes on a case-by-case basis. And it particularly identifies the significance of stream shade as a factor determining stream temperature and directs staff to address shade-related temperature concerns through existing authorities and processes. And it acknowledges that site-specific factors must be considered when addressing temperature issues. A number of concerns have been expressed about this resolution. Those concerns, the most common concerns are that this resolution describes a one-size-fits-all approach and doesn't allow for flexibility. However, this policy statement doesn't determine any specific implementation measures. the regulatory approach described in the resolution defers specifics of implementation of the temperature objective to permitting and enforcement actions that have a separate public process. And as I said, it relies on site-specific considerations on a case-by-case basis. And so we think that it provides adequate flexibility. Another concern that's been expressed is that this policy statement leaves too much uncertainty. And, you know, this is the flip side of the previous comment, and it's the common dynamic we see in trying to balance specificity with certainty. I think that this approach allows for those site-specific considerations on a case-by-case basis, and it's appropriate to do that in the way that it's laid out. And we've found the right balance there. And finally, another concern is that this is a policy that should only be applied to impaired waters, but that's inconsistent with state law and the basin plan and wouldn't achieve the goal of implementing the water quality objective in all places where it applies. So we have some changes to the resolution to go over. The changes are outlined in the change sheet in your packet and out on the front table. These are minor corrections resulting from conversations with parties to the stipulated agreement on TMDL implementation. And these changes clarify areas of overlap between the resolution and agreement. They don't result in any changes of direction or outcome and are non-substantive. So I'd like to go over those.
And Brian, to add that they were directed by the board.
They were directed by the board. Thank you. So the first of those changes is in the title and header of the document, and it's simply inserting the word statement after policy. This change and a couple of the others are meant to draw a distinction between this policy statement and a temperature policy basin plan amendment. There are changes to finding number 14, where we've added the names of plaintiffs that filed the lawsuit, and deleted a sentence at the bottom, and you'll see that sentence has been placed further down. Because we've added a couple of findings, there needs to be some renumbering. Number 3 addresses that. Change number 4 is a new statement that simply describes the stipulated agreement. And acknowledges a deliverable there. The fifth change is the last sentence of the previous 14. That's nothing new, just a new location. The sixth change is a matter of keeping numbering correct. As we've added some paragraphs, we need to keep the consistency there. And item 7 is a change to the first statement in the therefore be it resolved section, again, to acknowledge the distinction between this policy statement and temperature policy basin plan amendment, and two words are added there. On 12, this direction to staff, the word should has been changed to shall. And finally, the last paragraph in the resolve section changes the temperature policy to this policy. Those are the entirety of the changes. And at this time, I'd like to ask Ms. Olson to come forward and clarify some aspects of law.
Check. Good morning. This is Samantha Olson, your staff counsel. This is a pointy hat alert. Some of you guys may find this incredibly riveting, and some may find it mind-numbingly boring. So I'm just going to roll through a couple of slides. Let me bring up this one. Sam's slides. So we received a comment. It was after the close of the written comment period, but we received a comment from Jason Perbuco, who raised several legal issues. In his comment regarding the regional board's authority to regulate shade. So specifically, Mr. Perbuco questioned how incident solar radiation could be treated as a non-point source pollutant, and questioned whether it could be considered waste for the purposes of our waste discharge requirements. He raised questions about the integration of state and federal law, specifically where it concerns temperature TMDLs, and also seemed to suggest that the state Porter Cologne Water Quality Act could only regulate discharges of sewage waste. So I've developed a few PowerPoint slides that attempt to address these issues. Can you forward that for me? 4 to be exact. The Regional Water Board has broad authority. As you know, we implement two primary statutes, the Federal Clean Water Act and the State Porter Cologne Water Quality Act. And as a result, since we're delegated authority to implement the Clean Water Act, our state law and basin plan is a blend of state and federal law. The Porter-Cologne Act is meant to be comprehensive. In fact, reading from the legislative history from a study that led to the recommendation that resulted in the promulgation of the act in 1969, I'll read the following quote. Over the past two decades, the state has controlled water pollution by regulating waste discharges, but there is now an increasingly urgent need for a greatly expanded comprehensive control program covering the many other factors, apart from waste disposal, that affect water quality, such as impoundments, saline water intrusion, and land use. Our basin plan is our primary tool for regulating. It's a water quality control plan. It includes designated beneficial uses, objectives to protect the beneficial uses, and implementation plans. Our commenter he raised questions about the Clean Water Act, and I think his understanding of the Clean Water Act was too narrow, but I think it stems from the idea that the permitting program of the Federal Clean Water Act really only deals with what we call NPDES discharge permits, and those are for point sources of discharge. That's a discrete conveyance such as a pipe or canal, and that is true, that federal permits only apply to point source. However, the Clean Water Act contains many provisions that are not necessarily associated with the NPDES permitting program that get assimilated into our basin plan and, in fact, into Porter-Cologne Water Quality Act. That includes Section 303D, which leads to the listing of impaired water bodies and development of TMDLs and such. It's not explicit in the resolution, but I want to point out that the regional board's basin planning authority is, in fact, broader than our implementation authority. And what I mean by that is, for example, you could promulgate an objective that would inform other agencies with jurisdiction over a temperature activity. But our implementation authority, for the most part, is triggered by a discharge of waste or a threatened discharge of waste. So all our cease and desist orders, our cleanup and abatement orders, our waste discharge requirements all deal with discharges of waste. This board came close to promulgating a flow objective in the Shasta TMDL, for example. You could have the authority to promulgate a flow objective that would inform the Division of Water Rights, for example, to take that into consideration when it processes water right applications or change petitions, et cetera, and other agencies as well. And I think it sort of recognizes that in the resolution is implementation specific. It's mostly focusing on implementation, and so that's why it's not explicit in there. But it does recognize working with other agencies and such. I can find the specific finding if you're interested. So I just wanted to make sure that point was made clear. Water quality control is defined as the regulation of any activity or factor which may affect quality of the waters of the state, and that's in Water Code, that's defined in Water Code Section 13050, Subdivision I. Heat is defined as a pollutant by EPA, and so that's what led to the development and adoption of temperature TMDLs. But we need to recognize that heat can come from many sources, not just thermal discharges, which is defined as a point source often associated with once through cooling facilities, but especially on the North Coast, our sources of heat primarily come from the removal of shade. We're largely a non-point source region, and so we also need to recognize that we're not talking about sunlight as a discharge. We're talking about the removal of shade being a controllable factor. In the context of an activity that regulates waste discharges, we can also condition those permits to address controllable water quality factors associated with the activity that causes the discharge. I liken this to a line of cases, federal cases, that resulted in the seminal Supreme Court decision, PUD number one of Jefferson County. This had to do with a different implementation provision, Section 401 of the Clean Water Act, but it's similar in that there the court found once the discharge triggered the jurisdiction of the state to issue a certification, the state could then regulate the entire activity and its water quality impacts in the context of that permit. It's also very important to note that riparian management, including shade controls, also provide additional water quality benefits related directly to the discharge of waste. That's in finding 22 of the resolution. And so that's things such as filtering the sediment and other waste as it passes through a buffer zone, and also preventing stream bank erosion. So I'll conclude with that, yes, the regional board has very broad authority, but it does implement it in a reasonable, efficient, and responsible manner. As you know, the resolution does not predetermine any specific requirements. Temperature mitigations will be based on relevant factors on a case-by-case basis with an additional public process so that parties can participate in that. And again, the resolution expressly acknowledges working with numerous other agencies and programs with jurisdiction over temperature. That concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you for the clarification, Mr. John Corbett.
Well, first, just to clarify the hearing record, we, in a prior hearing, excluded written testimony that wasn't timely and any objections thereof, and I assume to be consistent, we would need to exclude Mr. Perot's testimony from the record and then treat your statement as merely a positive staff report, because otherwise, we're not being equal on our enforcement of the deadlines.
The problem with that is the way that the resolution was rolled out. In fact, public comment closed, but then the board directed us to continue working with parties, and I believe already allowed those written comments into the record.
Mm-hmm. So you believe it was a timely, that the board has ruled it's timely?
The board has not ruled it's timely. However, because of the board's direction to work with these parties, I would hesitate to exclude those written comments.
Because in the future, and I'm not going to spend any more time on it, when we ask you to work with the parties, I never intention to change the written comment period.
Understand. I mean, we were really hopeful to come to a resolution. In fact, did work very well with those parties. And I would consider this presentation here an oral response to those comments.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Mr. Corbett, I believe at our last meeting our written comment period had already been closed, and that though the direction was to, there was opportunities to continue, we took testimony at that meeting, right, and those comments carried over into additional conversations with staff, and so I'm interpreting this as a report back on one of those conversations that had taken place, or communication between interested party and staff.
Right. Well, actually, for clarification, I mean, we did meet again with parties. However, the comments that I just addressed were submitted prior to that. And in fact, it wasn't very fair, but I thought, well, Brian can do these legal slides. And so he did, and I thought he did a good job, but made a couple misstatements. And so this was really an attempt to go back and clarify the presentation of those slides. Right. From the last
Well, meeting. That's why I was saying a positive statement of staff. And that can be irrespective of whether we admit into evidence, and also irrespective of whether staff meets with people, and they take that into account all the time on positive statements to the board. I just never imagined that we give the interpretation we're readmitting written testimony. I'm not sure that's fair to other people who may not have understood that either. But we are where we are.
Well, I don't think a determination was made by the then chair to accept the additional written comments. So I think it would be at the discretion of the board at this point. But again, I should also mention, we're contemplating that we're going to move into a rulemaking and that these issues are going to be further fleshed out in that process. And so my concern is less with this record, because we imagine a much bigger record through the Basin Plan Amendment process.
Right, and I intend to clarify that in a little bit. But.
Okay.
Mr. Massey.
It's undoubtedly obvious, but I think it's worth stating, because there was a question in the last issue that we dealt with over late submissions. From a lay perspective, and not the legal question of it, but why don't we or do we allow late submissions? And the problem for me as a board member is that I get a packet which is very thick. And then the morning or the evening before, someone wishes to lay 18 pages on me, and it's just impossible to digest the material. And so the only thing that I would say, and it makes it very, very difficult on staff particularly, but if those late submissions are such that they really have a bearing, then I want a postponement. I don't want to make a decision based on material that I've never read, haven't digested, or based on something that's terribly lacking. Mm-hmm. And it is one which, excuse me, bedevils not only us as a board, but I think probably every other public entity. And so where we have a hard and fast rule, I apologize as to whether it's fair or unfair to some particular party, but I don't want late submissions because I don't get the opportunity to read them. And if this is really significant, then we just simply postpone it, and I will read it in that period in between. But it's just terribly, terribly difficult as a board member to live with those. Thank you.
Okay, I understand. And I guess I'm just thinking back now that Jason Perbuco did submit, I believe, a first set of comments, and this would have been his second set. And it is at the board's discretion whether you want to include or exclude, and I am fine if you want to exclude it from the record. I wouldn't recommend postponement. I think, you know, we've gone around a couple times on this one, and I feel confident that the comments that were in the record have been adequately addressed, and even the ones, even if you choose to exclude, have been addressed. So
I didn't want to cut you off.
Let's finish.
Okay. These three comments that you've brought up, we've had them submitted within the time frame previously. We've had them orally from him as well. I remember those vividly. And so it sounds like you're going over them a third time. This isn't new information. This isn't earth-shattering. It isn't something that's going to change the document. We've discussed it. We've talked about it. You've even given an opinion about it orally in previous meetings. So I think that satisfies Mr. Massey's question of, is this something that we should consider or postpone? I say absolutely not. Okay.
May I also say that this is the first process in a two-step process, and you're absolutely right, Sam, that the rulemaking process has yet to come. And so if we have late submissions and the passions that are involved in some of those late submissions, those can be carried forward to the process that is going to be engaged in next. And so I concur with my fellow board members that if there are late submissions, I would ask that they be included. And if somebody wants to give testimony today on what they're doing, I don't want a half-hour dissertation and them going through line by line of their late submissions if we have them here today. But I would rather have a succinct, give me your three high spots, and then save that passion and information for going forward for the rulemaking process.
And just to build on that, we, at our last meeting, had reminded everybody that the written comment period was closed. It was indeed closed, and that we would be moving forward only with verbal testimony. Okay.
Thank you. I have four speaker cards. Carrie Fisher, California Farm Bureau Federation, followed by Ed Struffenigger. Another one? Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Now that's after 12, good afternoon, board. My name is Carrie Fisher with the California Farm Bureau Federation. And kind of to preface what I know what you guys were talking about was with regard to the comments that Farm Bureau submitted on behalf of the ag industry and the forestry industry yesterday. Some of the things were not touched on. At the last meeting in November, we were directed by the board to continue working with staff. We tried to do that in December. Unfortunately, for some unknown reason not apparent to us, that communication on behalf of the board staff fizzled, and we were kind of left high and dry. Some of my fellow colleagues, unfortunately, gave me the big stick to carry today due to illnesses and conflicts, couldn't come. But some of them had conversations with former chairman, and were directed to actually bring our revisions on the document, line by line, to you guys today. So that's what we did. And so I'm a little confused by the back and forth that we're getting, because we tried to do something, we're told to do something else, we're doing it, and now it seems like it's not being received. So I don't know if you want to address that now, if you want me to just go through the most important points that we did make to the document, and we also brought copies.
Yeah, Ms. Fisher, if I could just respond to that. If I recall, there, when you appeared last time with the comments, mm-hmm. and they were written comments, and we had made the ruling that we weren't accepting any more written comments, and you had informed me that you had prepared those at request of staff.
Yes.
And I said, okay, I didn't realize it was a staff request. By all means, you can submit those to staff, and we'll take those. And then we received testimony, and that was that. So I don't recall giving any direction beyond that to prepare additional comments. There was obviously the testimony was given to, and people were still engaging with staff on that, but I don't recall giving specific
directions.
This
is a telephone call that you had with Gary Reneerson, who was unable to come today, but mm-hmm. I have talked to him numerous times. He took the notes from your conversation, and that was what he passed on, that you had directed him to bring our revisions to you guys today.
It was when I had that phone conversation with Gary, which I disclosed this morning in my ex parte, was that he had called to inform me that a meeting had taken place between staff and a group of folks to talk about the comments, mm-hmm. the very ones that you had brought forward to us. And I said, hey, that's fantastic. Glad you guys are still working on it. And he said, it's my understanding that staff are going to be taking our comments and revising the document based on that. And I said, okay, that sounds fine. Let's just make sure that what we see on our webpage is the same version that we have in our agenda packet, which is the same version that you guys were talking about. And he said, yep, agreed on that. And I said, okay, then look forward to seeing you at the meeting to back up whatever, you know, to convey to us and communicate whatever comments that had transpired in that meeting.
Okay. Gary has a different perspective of what he was directed to do.
Sure. And I realize you're in a difficult position to be here for that. And I'd be happy to continue that conversation with Gary, because if I misinterpreted something from him, then I apologize for doing that. And that's when I walked away from the conversation. That's what I took from that.
He had a very different perspective and has been emailing me all day asking
okay.
taking his comments. So
sure.
Let's wait a minute. Kat, did you have something to say on that?
Yeah, I don't know if this will help or clarify at all. It has gotten more confusing than it ought to be. But I think when Carrie mentions it kind of fizzled, I think that was the point where staff said, you know, we're done and we're not going to make any more changes. We're going to go with what we have. And so while the board of directors to keep talking, there comes a point in time in document production where we just kind of go, we're done. And, you know, then the feedback was, if you want to bring it to the board, and, you know, you persuade them that your changes that you want to make are the right changes, because as staff, we've cut it off.
And I think what the main concern is, it seems to be that there's a lot of internal conflict, because some member of our group, the Ag Forestry group, talks to staff, and staff tells us, and we write it down, I mean, we're not lying here, that the board directed them to not take any more comments from us. And then we talk to the board, and the board tells us, staff told us we're not going to make any more changes. So we're here trying to make this the best policy and getting conflicting back and forth, and it's just becoming a very confusing policy that it doesn't need to be.
And I can appreciate the when we play telephone like this, how it's more confusing than it ought to be.
Yeah.
But I think what staff was trying to say, and perhaps has said inartfully, is just what Mr. Hales said, was we were directed pretty clearly as make a cutoff and bring the document. And so there came a point in time that we said we made a determination as staff of we were done. And so we weren't going to make any more changes. So I think that's kind of the telephone piece of when you heard the board said no more changes. What we were saying is we were done, and perhaps we didn't communicate that as artfully.
Yeah,
I don't
think that happened, because the meeting then occurred a month after the board meeting. So if that was the case, why did we even meet?
And as I recall, Mr. St. John, was this the meeting that you warned people that we were not going to be making any changes, and whether or not we should have that meeting or not, and whether or not that was a good idea to proceed? So we went into the meeting with that notification to the parties.
Mr. Corbett, did you want to add something?
Well, I do want to advise you can orally make your points, whether we got them in a formal written document. But I reaffirm, Mr. Massey, I haven't even seen this stuff, and it's really hard to have things admitted in the record. You don't even have the opportunity in the board here to read. But I think if you give a good oral summary of the points you want to raise, that would be appropriate.
Okay.
That was exactly the message that I had given to Mr. Reneerson, which that was at least what I had hoped that I had told him was that, you know, whether out of the product of this meeting, whatever changes that or whatever the discussion was in terms of hopes for changes in the document, that if they did not get adopted into the document or not incorporated, then we'll see at the meeting and we'll hear them orally at the meeting, because that's really the process within which we have to move. We can't do this behind the scenes. So, and it's, you know, I'm apologizing on the record if I gave the wrong information, if there was a miscommunication which has had a ripple effect. I don't think I did, and Gary's not here, but
right.
That's all right. We'll clearly sort it out. We are where we are. And so, at obviously Mr. Chair's direction, I would say, you know, let us hear what you have and give us the details.
So Mr. Fisher, let me
simple, just Mr. Hales. Blame Gary. He's not here.
I'll make sure I pass that along.
I don't know what kind of comments or suggestions you have in front of you, or written comments, or how extensive those are. I would ask, given the interest of time and given the knowledge that we have a process, a rulemaking process that has yet to come, that is going to be robust, extensive, and provide plenty of opportunity for public comment and input from affected stakeholders and interested parties, I would ask that you take the next 5 minutes and give us your best shot and hit the high points.
I would just say that although I appreciate your comments on that, a lot of our comments go to the very nature of the policy itself. And so even though you're having a future rulemaking, if the actual policy is completely flawed to begin with, we're set up for failure.
Well, let me say that I guess that's a point of interpretation. So if you feel this document's flawed, I respect that opinion from you. I don't see it that way. So you got 5 minutes to give
All
us
right,
your best
I
shot.
I will go through. And for the record, I have provided courtesy copies to your staff and here for the board members.
Thank you.
Our major theme is the application of the policy. There needs to be a clearly explain the differential between TMDL and non-TMDL watersheds. Temperature measures should only apply to the non-listed water bodies and watersheds where necessary and appropriate. The term or phrase necessary and appropriate has been added in various spots throughout the different provisions of the policy in order to clearly explain the application of the policy according to Porter Cologne. We did have a suggestion for, and I know you guys don't have it in front of you since it's with your clerk, for 14 with regard to temperature implementation policy. We made some specific changes to address the application of the policy and modified the last sentence to reflect that non-impaired watersheds should not be treated in the same exact manner as impaired. With regard to clarity and certainty of the overall policy, certain terms are used throughout the policy that are not defined. They're not legal terms. They have no definition, or there is no authority to back up the use of the terms. So we asked for a certain clarity, perhaps to use a different term, an actual legal term, so that all people reading the policy will know what they mean. For example, controllable water quality factor. What is the definition of water quality factor? Where is the authority of it with regard to Porter Cologne? With regard to shade, we did add some clarifying suggestions and language. Although the staff presentation says that nothing is mandated in this policy, it does give specific language that requires no removal of shade in all instances. We have the scientific backing to suggest that in certain instances you may be able to cut a tree to change some foliage, to change some vegetation, and to not have a detrimental or any impact on temperature within a stream. So therefore there's language changes that need to be changed in order to allow current non-impaired practices to take place. This also is with regard to the term site potential shade. That's a very specific term for RPFs, registered forest practitioners, that should be used only in the way that it is used in that context and not have a broad application. With regard to the overall tenor of the document, management practices that affect shade may not necessarily result in adverse impacts to temperature. This also is with regards to some of the livestock language that is throughout the document. So therefore, there must be language that includes evaluation of proper processes and be relevant to the various watersheds and should not be applied on a region-wide general conditions, although it is said by staff that this is supposed to be done on site specific or case-by-case basis. When you actually read the document, there are very broad applications that do not allow this case-by-case basis to continue. With some of the specific concerns, there's only listed certain beneficial uses. We question that and ask that all beneficial uses be included in the policy so that you don't encourage taking a narrow or biased approach to water quality beneficial uses. With regards to the terms consistent with natural conditions, we ask for explanation on what this means, since there's a difference between the legal definition of natural conditions and how it might be interpreted by those reading the policy. And this is with regards to how far back do you consider natural conditions to go, since it doesn't have a defined definition in this policy. Current language, as I stated earlier, implies that absolutely no removal of any sort of shade-bearing vegetation. So we would suggest the use of terms such as maintain adequate shade to disregard this complete prohibition as currently addressed. And then with regards to livestock, the language concludes that livestock causes harm to riparian areas in all instances. This is not necessarily true. Unfortunately, my colleague Jack Rice couldn't be here to testify since he does have cattle in the North Coast region and can give you examples of how it will not impair water quality and temperature objectives in all cases. So that was some of the main gist.
I appreciate you fitting that in 5 minutes. You definitely covered the high points. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
And I apologize, by the way, for any misinterpretation or confusion. This thing's been a struggle for us as well because there's been a lot back and forth. Any board member comments or questions?
Thank you guys very much.
Thank you, Carrie. Mr. Ed Struffenegger, followed by Daniel Meyer.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and board members. I'm Ed Struffenegger with the California Forestry Association, and I've come up here before to talk on the same issue at the previous hearings. I guess in a nutshell, we're recommending California Forestry Association and our members who represent forestry, forest management interests, timber interests in California. We respectfully request that you don't adopt the policy as presented and as noticed. The resolution, as Carrie had mentioned, we feel has a number of flaws in it. Your comments were well taken that this is not rulemaking, this is a policy of resolution. We see that if we start down this path of going in the wrong direction with this, with the policy, that the basin plan amendments can go ahead and take basically go in the wrong direction also. So we think that it's important that the regional board get this right. In our opinion, that there are enough flaws in this policy and this resolution, so that we recommend that you don't go ahead and adopt it at this time. Some of the more specific concerns that we have with the California Forestry Association is that we don't feel that a lot of the best science and a lot of the best data have been incorporated into this policy. That there are some characterizations and some statements in here that may or may not be reflective of the best science and the best data out there. There's been a lot of research. There's been a lot of information out there with regard to temperature and shade, with regard to forest ecosystems put out by anybody from Jackson Demonstration Forest to UC Cooperative Extension to the Board of Forestry. This has been addressed very specifically When the Board of Forestry adopted the what's called the ASP rule package in 2009, the Anadromous Cell-Mounted Protection Rule Package, which greatly enhanced the riparian buffer protection measures in all streams with anadromy. I'm very appreciative that this board early on did go ahead and change the policy as written to go ahead and include some of those changes with regard to ASP watersheds. But in a more general sense, not all watersheds in the North Coast region are ASP watersheds or anadromous watersheds. And we think that the policy needs to be changed and incorporate the fact that there are a number of very specific and extensive protection measures out there for riparian areas within the forest practice rules as a whole, as they apply to different areas and different classes of streams. We think that some of the statements concerning that were put forth in the policy don't have, they didn't have a reference in there, a literature citation, or where they came from, and these were generalizations made about the, for example, the shrinking of cold water ecosystems. Is that or is that not correct? Well, compared to what time, what period of time, when was the data collected, things like that. So this sort of goes down this path that, well, does this sort of set you up for having questions later on about the actual data and information in here? I think one of the other parts that we need to go ahead and talk about is the regulation of forest management activities in California. There's a very extensive list in the policy of many of the other federal and state regulating agencies in forestry. It's a good list, but I think it needs a lot of clarification. I mean, as somebody who just picked up the document and didn't know about the regulations in California would have no idea of the extensive regulatory framework that's associated with all those different agencies. And I think that needs to be further delved into, that needs to be further articulated in the policy, so that when step number two of this process comes around, namely the amendments to the basin plan and new basin plan, that we go ahead and have a good framework in place to go ahead and say that these policies are not, or these changes are not required because they're adopted as part of other agencies' policies, or that there needs to be something else and go from there. But I think that unless we have some kind of detail following up this list, that there's going to be some problems down the line. I think also that the comments have been made previously that there's a lot of geographic and hydrographic type of variability within the North Coast region. We didn't see where that was really addressed in there, that we need to go ahead and have some discussion of that. So I think that I've been in contact with Carrie and this working group between ag and forestry. They've been working on this now for about 2 months. And I've been involved with a lot of the emails and a lot of the changes and whatever else. And I think the board should give very serious consideration to that. And if you need more time to go ahead and look at these changes, I would recommend that you go ahead and take that time to go ahead and look at those changes. But I recommend that the board does not adopt the resolution as presented. Thank you.
Thank you, Ed. Any comments or questions from board members?
Ed, one question while you're still there. Yeah, I'm going down the list. I've got my notes from our previous meeting, and I'm just going through the list of your comments, and it sounds like some of them were addressed, but some of them weren't. Is that accurate to say that, or is it that none of them were addressed?
I think early on in the process, I think one of the major points that we had was that the riparian protections afforded to anadromous watersheds under the forest practice rules with the ASP watershed needed to be addressed. And that was done very early on. And I do appreciate that because that's a very important point. But I think in a more general sense that all the other watersheds that aren't ASP watersheds or all the stream classes that are not really in that, class one and class two of the Board of Forestry defined streams, that those need to be addressed in sort of the same light. Mm-hmm. And talking about the, you know, the forest practice rules as a big blanket, and then we have in a specific case, we have the ASP rule package that protects certain water courses and certain watersheds, and go from there. So yes, you're correct. At the early on, that was addressed and that was changed, which I appreciate, but the other changes were not made.
Okay, thanks.
No other questions? Thank you, Ed.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Daniel Meyer, followed by Mark Hannon.
Good morning. My name is Daniel Myers. I'm representing the Sierra Club. I'd like to express my appreciation to the board and staff for considering some of the changes that we had needed to make to resolve the differences between our settlement agreement and what was proposed in the draft. And so we do support the policy as it is proposed with the changes. I just had a couple of points that I'd like to address looking forward, and that is that during our negotiations, there were a couple of occasions in which my expectations of what was going to come were questioned, and my expectations in this are nothing more than the language that we have agreed to in the settlement. But the fact is that there is a question about what we believe comes out of this process looking forward. I think it's important that we have a couple of periods of review over the next 2 years so that we see, we have the opportunity to make sure that we are on the same page with what we're doing in compliance, not only with the policy, but with our settlement agreement. And I have one other suggestion. I think this our agreement indicated that the policy should be modeled on the old sediment policy. The sediment policy had several conditions where they looked at staffing needs and reported what would be required. And I think we need to do that with this document as well. And I don't see any reason not to do it. It can be done either within the implementation. It can be done in a separate resolution, which was done under the sediment policy. They actually passed a resolution, and they said we need more people to do this. And I think in this case, where we're doing this where it's a requirement that has been supported in the litigation by the state and the Attorney General's office, I think you have the backbone to get people where you need them and ask for it in this. And I would recommend that be at least considered. Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. Any comments or questions from the board? Thank you, Mr. Mark Hannon, followed by Matt Green. We'll save Matt Green. Alan Levine.
Good afternoon. I am Mark Hannon. I am a forester with Campbell Timber in Fort Bragg. We thank the staff for the additional modifications to the resolution and are grateful to the board for the extended opportunity to make comments. As you consider this matter further, please make the important distinction between policies that may be appropriate for temperature-impaired watersheds and the processes that are needed for unimpaired watersheds. One size does not fit all. Please continue to recognize and avoid duplicating the effective and extensive existing regulations that have important temperature effects, the forest practice rules, the stream bed alteration agreements, the general waste discharge requirements, as well as restoration projects. And please remember that monitoring is every bit as difficult as it is important. The processes to be evaluated take place in highly variable conditions. Please have your staff first develop a draft monitoring proposal for your consideration. with, of course, adequate time for evaluation, public comment, field testing, if possible, and refinement before implementation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Any comments or questions from the board? Thank you. Alan Levine, followed by Matt Green, which I understand is has some comments that are via email that may be read into the record.
Good afternoon. Alan Levine for Coast Action Group in Point Arena. We support the resolution. But before I get into the temperature aspect, you have a procedural problem with CEQA when stuff comes in late. And I know how frustrating it is when things come in late because you have everything set up and it's a monkey wrench into what you were planning to do. But CEQA demands that all relevant comments until close of comments be considered. And I think the only way around it is closing public comment, and if you don't have time to consider anything new, you have to wait to the next meeting for approval if there's serious questions raised. I don't know any other solution. But my suggestion is to stay out of CEQA trouble so you don't get litigated. So, okay, waste and pollutants. Temperature's a pollutant. It's a limiting factor for salmon survival in Northern California streams as far as all stages of salmonid life cycle. And I wanted to support Samantha Olson's discussion about the law, but if you go to the federal law, Proncelino versus Marcus, and then the Ninth Circuit upholding that decision, the lower court was Judge Alsup. The other case was Proncelino versus Nastri, and it was all about shade and trees being taken to create shade in the stream for temperature considerations. And Judge Alsup and the appeals court both said that all dischargers and all pollutants must be considered. So that's federal law support for what's going on in Puerto Colón. Removal of shade is a controllable situation. Part of what supported that decision that Judge Alsup initially made was that testimony by CDF, Cal Fire now, but CDF before, that yes, there are many, many cases that come up where additional shading is required. So it's well within your purview and your mandate to set temperature objections and objectives in the basin plan. Another way you can do it is individual TMDLs for listed water bodies. But that's a lot harder and more arduous and more expensive. Controllable factors, there was a question about that. That's described in the basin plan, too, in your anti-deg clause. I heard a discussion just a little while ago about the ASP rules, which are an improvement. But if you go back to all the studies about the effectiveness of the forest practice rules, including comments made by regional board staff to the Board of Forestry, including the Coastal Zone Management Act reauthorization and all scientific review panels, the forest practice rules do not protect beneficial uses per se. So you need the ASP rules, they help. Your rules in your WDRs and your waivers help more. But don't rely on the ASP rules. They could be gone not at your discretion, at the discretion of the Board of Forestry. And I just want you to know that they're considering a variable ASP depending on, well, for example, if I dump a tree in this stream, can I take so much shade to make up for that tree I gave the river? The forest practice rules, the main failure in its ability to protect water quality values or basin plan mandates is that the rules are the bare minimum standard to be met. And there's a lot of in-lieu practices or variable applications. And you have the rule, And you have the variance, and sometimes the variance doesn't meet the standard of protecting the resource. In fact, that's often the case. And this is going to come up in our discussion of NTMPs. You need to do your job setting the standards that we need to protect for water quality values. The Department of Forestry and the Board of Forestry will do their job about trees, but we still have our responsibility to water quality. Thank you.
Thank you. Any comments or questions? Thank you, Alan. I understand there's some comments from Matt Green that are via email that perhaps are going to get read into the record. Is that perhaps correct?
So this is Matt. I'm Matt St. John of your staff. And reading into the record comments submitted by Matt Green of Cal Forestry, but submitting the comments on behalf of himself. Reading, all, I am sick with the flu currently and do not wish to infect anyone else with this, so I won't likely be attending tomorrow. I know that this isn't protocol to accept this email in exchange of public testimony, but I feel that it is the only avenue upon me at this point. However, if possible, please pass this on to the board. Mr. Chairman, I would like to urge this board to consider putting this resolution on hold for another month. The reasons for this are as follows. One, in a meeting with staff in December, staff told the people in attendance that no changes were going to be made, and this was the wish of the board. This went in direct conflict with what the executive officer said was going to happen at the last board meeting. She was very clear that the public had made some good suggestions that there was a need to make revisions. Two, staff was asked repeatedly this week if changes were going to be made, and the answer was no. Now, at the last minute, we get revisions to the resolution. This is an unacceptable and completely unprofessional. Your own rules require you to properly notice any action item 10 days prior to the board meeting. These changes were provided the afternoon prior to the meeting. Three, several substantial changes have now occurred to this resolution and no public comment period has been reopened. Four, it has been pointed out that it is the wish of staff to make this resolution clear and concise. However, one only has to read items 19 and 20 to realize that the order isn't concise. We have been assured by staff that it is not the intent of this resolution to eliminate the ability to work within the water and lake protection zones, item 19. However, item 20 says that even the removal of one tree will potentially increase stream temperatures. These two items can, as currently written, be left open to interpretation. A draft of proposed language cleanup is being presented to the board today. I urge you to consider what is in this draft and continue working with the public to create a better document. Sincerely, Matt Green.
Through the ethosphere. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Massey.
Without regard to the content of Mr. Green's email, I would urge all of us as this board that we consider what rules to operate under with respect to emails, which may be from ill and well-intentioned individuals who may well be ill in a hospital. But the reality is that Mr. Levine was here this morning on behalf of Riverwatch, and I don't want Pandora's box of 50,000 emails coming from wherever. So I'm not prepared to make a decision this morning, but there has to be some limitation to this stuff. This is essentially a submission.
Yes. Duly noted.
If I may.
Yes.
Just for what it's worth, the comments that are trickling in have been in the record. There's no new content. In fact, at some point, I hope staff has the opportunity to walk the board through these specific things and show you in the resolution where these changes have already been made to accommodate these concerns. And it's a little bit frustrating because I don't know how much more clear we can get in the document. We feel like we've responded to these comments, and so maybe Brian will or I can walk you through. I mean, let's just take the last one, for example, on 19 and 20, where the complaint that that's not concise. That has been, you know, it's a general statement about the TMDL load allocations, and it clearly says this policy is not intended to predetermine precise parameters for effective shade at a specific location or land use. And so when a party comes up and says this is an absolute prohibition and no tree can be cut down, they're simply wrong. They're not reading the plain language of the resolution. There are additional responses to almost every single comment. I wouldn't worry too much about these late comments. These are the same themes, and I think that's partly why staff cut off the additional communication, because we felt like we have clearly and adequately addressed all these concerns. And at some point, it's like, well, you need to just reread the resolution now with new eyes, because it has been changed, and those concerns have been accommodated.
Mr. Chair.
Well, I would recommend we just comprehensively exclude the written comments, including emails, because at the end of the day, if someone wants to appeal, they're going to be asked staff to prepare the administrative record. And we have gotten it so muddled what's in the administrative record. I don't know. And I'm supposed to have some idea. And two, I haven't read the stuff. And I just think, while it's clearly in the discretion of the board to let it in or not let it in, and you can do it individually, I just think we've gotten ourselves tied in knots. And if we just stuck with our policy and just ruled that all those are excluded, I think we're better off. And then it's very hard to argue prejudice if a staff is correct that they've been previously raised, plus we allowed oral testimony to respond to additional concerns.
One more, Mr. Messi.
If John says he's muddled, Lord, I'm in big trouble. It's just that simple. From a legal perspective, we are establishing a policy which will lead to a rulemaking, which will lead to a basin plan amendment. Is there anything legally in the process of doing this that cannot be changed by this board having once adopted this policy?
Member Massey, this is a non-binding resolution. It's not regulatory. It's very clear that it has no regulatory effect. And so the board will have additional opportunity to review these issues when the basin plan amendment comes in. And I'll just add also, which is odd that we're talking about the record, because it's a non-binding resolution, there really isn't an administrative record. And in fact, if this resolution gets petitioned, we'll respond with, that's not right, we need to wait for the rulemaking.
Thank you. With that, sir, I would give you a motion to adopt, and then we can discuss it.
Can I wait a minute? I think we had some questions and comments that were further beyond that. Yes, please.
In reading the... Thanks. Okay. I will admit that one of the first things I noticed in the in terms of the beneficial uses was that agriculture wasn't mentioned in those. And because it's speaking towards grazing and different things, I just wondered why. I just wondered why that wasn't included in there. I do realize that it says beneficial uses of water bodies, and it's not limited to. But I would just think that in terms of kind of a feel good thing for the folks that are in agriculture, that if it was in there, then it's recognized. I realize that that it's really important to put in all of the habitat and fisheries things. Those are huge, huge things. But I was just wondering why that one wasn't chosen to put in there, since it's addressing agricultural utilization of the water.
Sure. I identified beneficial uses that could be affected by temperature.
Okay, perfect. All right. That was my question. And then I just wanted to, Samantha already did it in reading in 19 and 20. I just was caught off guard, and as you read some of the text in front and some of the text behind, there it doesn't seem to kind of, it's not locked and loaded on one specific thing. It gives way for responsible parties to be involved in the planning, and it speaks to other agencies' requirements and things. So I guess I'm struggling along with some of the other board members as to why there's this huge fear over strong language when I'm not totally seeing that strength in that. It seems pretty open. I think it was left open so that more people could be involved in the future of this.
Well, I think as we continue to work with people, we realize that it can't be a one-size-fits-all. In fact, the better policy would be to hammer out the details in the specific permit for the specific land use.
Right.
So I want to direct the board members' attentions now to the therefore be it resolved, number three. This gets on several of the points the commenters made, and this reads, this policy in no way limits the state water board or regional water board's authority and discretion to develop riparian management measures as appropriate and necessary for a specific land use or geographic area, and in consideration of existing regulatory and non-regulatory programs in place that provide temperature protection. I mean, I don't know how to write anything more clear than that. I mean, I think that's my frustration is I don't know how much more clear we can get about reserving the discretion and when the specifics will be developed and that there will be another public process.
Well, I agree with the intent. I actually, when we get into the motion, I'm going to try and clarify, but that was limited to riparian management, and I want a full reservation of rights on everything, and we'll read that in the record before adoption. So I think it was a little narrow is one of the clarification problems.
We had a motion put forth, but before we did so, Brian, did you want to respond to either any of the discussion, the motion? Do you want to make an omelet out of the scrambled eggs here? How do you want to respond to any of this or provide any succinct summary or recommendation from staff?
I have a few things I want to add. One is just a little bit of clarification about interaction with stakeholders. We did meet with Mr. Rainierson and Mr. Green and Mr. Rice on, I think it was December 2nd. We said up front that we weren't considering changes. We discussed a number of changes they would like to see, and we stated that it was not changes that we were going to make, but that they had the opportunity to present those changes for this board's consideration orally at this meeting. But I do want to acknowledge that we sent them a copy of the resolution so that they could make track changes for clarity in their oral presentation, not as a written submission, a written comment. So I just wanted to make that clear. Secondly, I think, and it was expressed at that meeting, that that there is a lot of fear about this language and the possibilities. That concern was expressed as, well, you know, we know what you think, but what about staff that come 20 years later? That sort of sentiment. And I would say that this resolution is not going to be bearing on anything once we have a basin plan amendment put forward and adopted. This states a lot of things, but I will just remind everyone in attendance one more time, it's not regulatory, it's not binding, it doesn't have anything in here that will make anybody except for staff do anything particularly. It tells us to do what we do through our ordinary processes. And I understand that balance between being specific and leaving uncertainty is always one where different people are going to find themselves on different side of that balance. But we've tried to find a balance there that works and that is clear about where we're going, but isn't trying to sneak in some sort of rulemaking. And I would just encourage all the stakeholders to stay tuned and be a part of the next process as we enter into that.
Any comments, Mr.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you a question. We've had concerns about interagency coordination, particularly with CAL FIRE and others. The way I read it, this actually has a tremendous policy direction to cooperate and coordinate with those regulatory requirements. Is that your understanding, just to make it clear in the record? Because
yeah.
I thought we had coordination of the state board, coordination of cities, counties, CAL FIRE, just about everybody. And so that's a pretty strong policy statement from the board to work with them and their existing regs is
right.
How I read it.
Yeah, and, okay. And that's what I meant by this does direct staff to do some things.
Thank you for that.
Mr. Chair, I was remiss by suggesting that we adopt this, and I did not include the changes that we have done and that have been made this morning that we have.
Could I ask you maybe to state your motion from just to be succinct?
Just to be succinct, sure. That we adopt Resolution R1, 2012-0013, including the change sheet number one, which we have had now.
I'll second that, and then I do want to make some comments pre-vote.
Comments pre-vote, like now?
If you could call another board members, but yeah,
sir,
it would be appropriate. As a policy statement, it has some vagueness, and there have been concerns that it purports to be pretty far-ranging. So I wanted to give some clarifications, and the first one is... and then what I thought I'd do is read these off, have legal counsel comment on them, and then have it incorporated as board findings in the adoption of the policy. But the adopted policy provisions, while in compliance with state law for adopting a policy, are subject to and, in fact, anticipate further rulemaking, including independent and full due process provisions that will further protect environmental interests and private property rights. And so that's the first one. The second one is the policy as delineated is not a full nor exclusive enumeration of regional board rights and authorities. The third one is it should be clear the regional and state board, because we're dealing with our relationship with them, reserve any and all regulatory and basin plan regulatory authorities such as water quality, quantity relationships as defined by the State Water Resource Control Board and the San Francisco Bay Delta decision in the Port of Cologne Act. And the last one is the definition of state is to be broadly defined and it should be considered under the Federal Water Pollution Control Act as treatment as the state designations for regulatory and programmatic entities. And then that way, I think it's really clear that how it interfaces with some of the other laws and agencies. So I'd like to give that to council. Have her make a comment.
Member Corbett, those 4 points are fine and clear to me. However, let's just go back on number 4, the last one that you made about treatment as a state.
Yeah.
The point of that is there's a finding here, and I can't find it right this second, that deals with other agencies, and it's to acknowledge that tribes can be treated as a state. The definition may not be fully inclusive, and that's what that comment pertains to.
So we have a motion, we have a second, we have an amendment to the motion. Is there any opposition to the amendment of the motion by board members? Okay, so come back around. We have a motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Mr. Chair, I abstain. I feel that there has been some sufficient confusion on behalf of my conversation out with Mr. Einarsson, which may have caused some direction to the other parties, and in result, the process may have been skewed in their opinion, and for those reasons, I don't feel comfortable voting on this item.
Accepted. So the resolution's passed with one abstention. Now, the second step and the two-step, as I understand it, is
that... Now that we're turning our attention to a basin plan amendment process, consistent with the passing of that resolution and the triennial review, that basin plan amendment process, as we've stated a number of times this morning, has considerable opportunities for public input. Before we take any public input, we would like to offer this board the first opportunity to provide input and ask that you give us any direction that you see fit as we turn our efforts towards a basin plan amendment.
Thank you for that opportunity. Board members want to provide direction to staff at this time.
I agree with Mr. Corbett, Mr. Chair, that email submissions will be counted as written submissions, and they will be accepted up to whatever the deadline period is that we have for written comment, but that oral comments are oral comments, and they certainly can be delivered, such as Mr. Levine did, on behalf of someone, but that constitutes Mr. Levine's contribution on that day for that particular thing. So you cannot sequentially read me 20 things from other people. They must appear. But that we take control of our own process, that a written submission includes email.
Duly noted. Other comments?
Mr. Chair, one other note. I heard comments and concerns that the policy statement as prepared may provide a foundation or may imply a direction for basin planning. And to prevent that from happening, I'd like to have some assurance of public participation opportunities. I know we have those opportunities, but just for the public to be able to see what those opportunities are, for it to be clear, if maybe by our next meeting we can get an outline of just the basin planning process that shows where those engagement points will be.
We can do that, Mr. Hales. We can outline the process. Our intent, though, to be clear, would be to use as a starting place in that process as we do scoping, that this the resolution would be part of that record that we would be putting
Understood.
Forward. So we're clear on that.
Clear on that.
Okay.
Right. And I think we can make it clear in the as we go down the regulatory pathway how we're coordinating with other agencies, including Cal Fire and cities and so on and so forth. We're forever caught where people want a specific reference to a specific rule. I think the comment was made they can change, so I don't think we can do it that way, but we are trying to give a policy guidance to coordinate with other state governmental agencies, and there's no sense reinventing the wheel, but we want to do our job too.
Thank you. Mr. Corbett, did you have any other direction to staff?
No.
Nope. Anybody else have direction for staff? Ms. Harris.
I know you do this well, Brian, but I always have to shout out for the folks who the rules and the policies affect. Just make sure that everyone has the opportunity to be involved and that they have, and that they're heard. I think regardless of whatever side of the aisle you come down, you want to be heard by your regulators. And so I know you do a good job at that. So just keep it on and make sure that the communication lines are open.
Will do.
Thank you. Brian, I actually agree with Mr. Hale. I think it would be beneficial for us and for you and actually the participants in this process to have a schedule and work scope between now and December 2013 that lays out the process as you could see it from here. I think that would be very helpful for everybody involved. There was some substantive comments today that I think also you should consider as you start to go through this, and I didn't want to lose them in the mix, so I'm just going to offer them now. The issue has come up a couple times versus impaired versus unimpaired. The protection of shade and temperature is regardless of unimpairment. It's a protection of water quality. This does not, it does not, I believe, need to distinguish or should not distinguish between only applying to water bodies that are impaired. The protection of shade is a protection of shade, or temperature policy applies to all water bodies, for that matter. There was a suggestion to have a draft monitoring proposal. I'll just put that out there and remind you of that. As far as that goes, too, I think you have tools and consistency to consider here. Your major components between shade flow and sediment, I think, are your major high points within the policy statement as it's written now. Just to kind of take those singularly, I think that shade, site potential shade, I think, is still something that I hear quite often that people struggle with. And I think the better that staff can make that type of cogent argument and articulate what is site potential shade, how does it matter, why does it matter, and how do you then go about using that as a tool from which to either have as a goal or a goal post, I think that would be of benefit. With respect to flow, I think that staff should explore opportunities in the flow realm. I know that you work now, the policy statement is clear that you work now with the Department of Water Rights on applications as commenting as it pertains to this, but I think there could be other opportunities that goes there too. Daniel Meyer brought up the issue of the sediment work plan and policy as it goes. I think there could be some very a good cross-connection between the sediment work plan and the elements that are contained in that. Particularly, I believe there's 35 elements in the beginning of that policy that could then cross-connect and work as a dual purpose. Finally, I tell you that I think that you staff ought to consider the use of a prohibition within this process to capture anything that's not left out. Finally, I would echo Mr. Corbett in that we would reserve our right through this process to get back to anything and as far as our authority goes. So that's quite a mouthful, but I didn't want to leave that out now. I don't want to have I write things down, but at the same time, I just don't want to leave this out. I want it to be fresh on your page and not mine. So that's why I mention it here.
And natural background conditions of the stream temperatures. Make sure
Thank
we're
you.
Defining where we where we're getting that information and how far back and
I think, though, if you start with the schedule and work scope, I think you weave these thoughts and pieces into it as you go. You don't have to have them all hammered out by next meeting, but I think you could put some major elements and milestones. I think it would be informative of this community. And by the way, folks, I would encourage, there's a lot of passion on this. There's a lot of actually great knowledge here, and save that. Bring it to the rulemaking process, because actually my information is that the rulemaking process is actually going to use less words. So I'm figuring that there's going to be probably more angst over less words. So that's where we're going. And engagement and participation within that process, I think, is of benefit to everybody, including us, and especially us, and the process outcome. So with that, unless anybody had any further direction or comments to Brian here, I think we're done giving you direction. You've got an adopted policy. Thanks for all your hard work in this process. It's been kind of a crooked road, but we got there nonetheless. All right, we're going to break
Thank
for
you,
lunch. We'll be back at 1:40. Thank you.